Welcome to the ANews Podcast. This is episode 16 for June 16. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the nonsectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. Editorial. In defense of struggle. Anarchists are notoriously dreamers, unrealistic. Not utopian necessarily, but with an eye or two on a future that seems so far away as to be completely untenable. Maybe this is why radical academics have tended to be Marxists, at least until Apple and other corporate sponsors gave dreaming the seal of approval. To be seriously an anarchist has meant dedicating oneself to a project that we can practice daily, but that won't culminate in our lifetime, if ever. That daily practice, then, is a struggle. It is a struggle against the cynicism of the era, against the ennui of sadness, against the allure of the mainstream, against the appeal of people understanding you, against the easiness of not taking responsibility. It is a struggle to keep checking our assumptions, to spend time with people who help us do that, and who value it when we do that for them. Sometimes it is hard just to find those people. Does struggle become an end in itself? Would that be a problem? Would we even notice? Would it even matter? Does struggling all the time, celebrating it, reveling in it, mean that we don't recognize victories, or even want victories? What counts as a victory in a battle that is generations long? Rejection of the daily is hard and usually thankless. It can encourage martyrdom and being friendly with people just because they're around. But who can say how fruitful those relationships are other than the people in them? Do we tend to make nails of issues when we have a hammer? Of course. Sometimes we make it a goal to have lots of different kinds of tools ourselves, sometimes to be friends with people whose tools are different from ours. It is sad, however, when the hammer people band together against the screwdriver people who fight with the crowbar people who split with the machete people. Ultimately, struggle is a wide open word, including joy, inspiration, and community, much like other excellent words, like attack, like conflict, like anarchy. Own it. Make it yours. Celebrate it. Enjoy it. What's new this week? Interview with Daniel McGowan. For June 11th, this is a good 34-minute interview with someone who has done some solid time and who has lots of experience on both sides, as he did bottom line prisoner solidarity work for long-term prisoners before he went in. He also spent his time inside writing about his experiences and getting harassed for it. This is very interview style. The questions are all short, there's not conversation, and that is always kind of weird. It relies a lot on the interviewee telling good stories. Luckily, Daniel has a lot of valuable things to say. It cuts off abruptly, but he does finish his sentence.
June 11th, the history of a day of anarchist prisoner solidarity. From Crime Think, this is an interesting history for anyone who lived through it or who is dealing with the consequences of it today, which you know is all of us. Last week we talked a little about what it means to support prisoners. This goes into the history and why we see more days of support now as a more recent tactic by support groups. Quote, as more comrades entered prison, the model of one support crew for one prisoner seemed unrealistic, doomed to result in eventual isolation. This model also seemed to contribute to the depolitization of cases, as it tended to emphasize particular aspects of individual situations rather than developing an analysis of shared context. Bringing together solidarity for Mason and McDavid was a small step out of this trap, allowing for more communication and coordination across collectives and distances. It was also a decision not simply to react to the state's indictments, which acknowledged no relationship between the defendants' cases, but to assert new understanding of how we could struggle around both. Unquote.
An interview with Sandy Crabb about Marius Mason. In a sea of stories of entrapment, snitching, and informing, Marius Mason's story stands out as he was betrayed in multiple ways by his partner of many years. Marius is another inspirational example of someone who is active inside. Quote, my name is Cindy Crabb. I wrote the zine Doris, and I'm on Marius Mason's support team. I started doing really basic prison support in the early 90s when I basically sent my zine through to prisoners and had a little bit of correspondence with prisoners that way. Then later on, I did books to prisoners in Asheville, North Carolina, and I do it in Ohio now a little bit. First, I started writing Marius when a mutual friend of ours committed suicide, and I knew Marius would have one less pen pal, so I started writing him, and after a couple of years, he asked me if I wanted to join his support team. That evolved into more active prisoner support, trying to find out what wasn't happening and what needed to happen, how to get things more organized than they were, and facilitate him getting more support. Unquote.
Now in the Anarchy of Destituent Power, Reading Politics with the Invisible Committee, from Autonomies. This is the third of the posts on Now, the new essay from the Invisible Committee. Autonomies is publishing reflections on the essay. Quote, "The Invisible Committee's most recent essay, Now, argues that the problem abides in the separation of politics from other spheres of life. Politics is thus reified, made a thing, something that can be referred to by the use of a noun. If, however, it is denoted by the use of an adjective, then it reveals itself not as something substantive, fixed, but rather as a way of being. One is politically a way of being in the world in opposition to, in conflict with, other ways of being." Unquote.
Paris, a second trial of the struggle against the deportation machine. From Bordered by Silence, translated by Indie Media Nantes. Quote, "From this point, after 5 years of preliminary inquiry, 2009 to 2014, and of bail conditions that were only lifted in 2015, while the foot soldiers of the anti-terrorist section of the Criminality Brigade searched in vain for those responsible for the attacks, this struggle, with its contents and uncompromising proposals, will be put on trial 7 years after the actions in question. After a series of partial withdrawals of charges handed out late in the game, the seven comrades and companions will finally be put on trial for refusing to give their DNA and fingerprints. Four of them are charged only with this. Two for having willfully damaged the offices of Air France and for having willfully damaged the offices of the SNCF and Bouygues Telecom. Further information and texts will follow later." Unquote.
Anarchy versus Yoga. This is by regular A-News poster Fav Noir, a bit more wing-nutty than usual, let's say, on the perniciousness of middle-class therapeutic techniques as a creeping somnolence as exemplified by yoga. Quote, "It didn't just beat anarchism, but also is, as we speak, beating Christianity, Judaism, Satanism, Scientology, Islam, maybe its next target, as well as it is having a decisive edge against most, if not all, of the defined countercultures. It eradicates at the trunk, not the roots, of course, the manufactured social need for a counterculture, in how it entertains social mechanisms of integration through a regular ritual of liquidation of the stresses caused by social constraints, exploitation, and discrimination. It is a fascinating, and not to say fascizing, form of self and communal pacification that does not require drugs." Unquote.
Anarchist prisoner David Delagoux's communique concerning his escape attempt. From Anarchia, this is an inspirational message showing how resistance of various sorts absolutely continues in prison. Quote, "The goal, to escape. The result, escape unsuccessful, which isn't a failure. The reason, the very strong bastard wind. The project, to redeem myself, widening my subversive gaze of revenge and launch a campaign of acts of self-liberation, hunted in each tiny movement with all the maniacal consequences of control that this implies in everyday life in prison, where I spend 21 hours a day in a cell. I waited for the last search on 30th of May before acting, and I also made a fool of the jailers during their beating of the bars that day. I spent the hours in the exercise yard between theoretical and practical elaboration, which led me to devise a perfect escape plan, given that limits in the mechanism of control and its sophisticated complexity can be detected. Faults that can be traced in all jails, revealing their hidden weaknesses." Unquote.
Philly machines malfunction for Dangerous June. Quote, "During the first half of Dangerous June, some machines decided to experiment with freedom. They expressed their solidarity with J20 arrestees and anarchists facing repression worldwide before taking their own liberating actions. Four security cameras flew away from their posts to see the rest of the world. A digital advertising billboard by a highway got a makeover. Four fare checking machines tried new foods and got constipated. A door to a security forces building chose to sleep in and delay work." Unquote.
"Your freedom is my freedom, the premise of anarchism." From Human Iterations, his blog, this is Gillis's offering to the Anarchy 101 conversation. Quote, "Anarchism is not and has never been a proclamation that if we overthrow a given state, wherever the extent of that state is to be drawn, utopia will immediately result. Anarchism is not a claim about human nature or a simplistic reflex of negation. Anarchism is daring to see beyond the suffocating language of power." Unquote.
"There is no civilization, there is no wild, there is only you and me." From the website godsandradicals.org, this is by Dr. Bones, a first-person recounting of a post-drug trip excursion and reflections on the world. Fun. Quote, When I see a member of the Outlaws Motorcycle Club, I see someone far outside of what we might call civilization. He actively wages war against a society he despises, looks only upon members of his own tribe as kin, and lives a nomadic life plundering what he can. Building nothing, taking everything, he is in shape and form a living barbarian, an echo of essence that might immediately be familiar to an ancient Mongol. Yet he rides a souped-up Harley, helps transport meth across state lines, and keeps in contact with his many girlfriends and suppliers over encrypted text. The clients I read cards for are the same kind of people who have always been in need, and the stories they bring me are as constant as the mosquito population in Everglades City. Heartache and health, wedding bells and funeral dirges, crazy risks, and the maddening dreams that push people to take them. The phone in our pocket has access to all the world's information and can literally put anyone in contact with anybody else around the globe. We use it to argue with strangers and masturbate to two-dimensional drawings. We shot a robot onto Mars and broke into laughter when it drew a dick on the planet's surface. We are still the same people we were thousands of years ago, unquote.
The First International and the Development of Anarchism and Marxism, from Anarchismo, written by Wayne Price. Price continues to be rare among older anarchists in his willingness to engage people on his ideas online. Usually by his age, anarchists have either left the scene entirely or are safely ensconced in an agreement bubble. Many groups seem to be speaking to newcomers these days, see the Black Rose podcast, for example. And here Price is also. Also going back to foundations, like the split between Marx and Bakunin in the First International, which, aside from some individual outliers, is the official start of a larger anarchism. He talks about most accounts of this being Marxist up till now, but that there are some recent new histories from anarchists. Quote, "The anarchists and Marx and other tendencies agreed that the International should promote labor unions everywhere. Marx's additional program was to demand that every national branch of the International form a political party to run in elections. He rammed through a resolution stating this at a completely unrepresentative gathering in London in 1871. However, Bakunin and the anarchists did not insist that the branches be forbidden to organize parties. Instead, they proposed that each section be able to decide for itself whether to run in elections, which was how the International had been operating from its inception. But Marx wanted the organization to be more centralized in order to demand party building." Unquote.
Houston Anarchist Book Fair, 9/24/2017. This is the announcement for the date, not the location, which has yet to be determined. For the Houston Book Fair, September 24th, so the week after the Bay Area one. The announcement offers a brief FAQ, which nicely acknowledges a breadth of definition. It also calls for proposals for workshops, panels, film screenings, etc., for which the deadline is August 1st.
Bad news. Angry Voices from Around the World, Episode 1. From the site aradio.blogspot.de comes this notice about bad news. Quote, "A monthly news program from the International Network of Anarchist and Anti-Authoritarian Radios, consisting of short news segments from different parts of the world. As an international network of radio projects, we believe in the importance of international solidarity, and we also recognize the importance and the need to create and disseminate our own media and counter information." Unquote.
An attack on all of us. A CrimeThink article, the headline of which is a quotation from Paul Ryan calling for, quote, "No shootings, but revolutionary social change," unquote, because we will be targets of the backlash after the shooting of Republican politicians, as if we wouldn't be targets otherwise.
Media projects. Free Radical Radio presents Leave Me Alone, Misanthropic Writings from the Antisocial Edge, an audio zine. Enemy Combatants is a fairly new pamphlet distro firmly in the egoist/individualist camp, publishing many little-known historical authors and collecting writings on specific themes. This episode of Free Radical Radio, aside from being introduced by a funny rant from Rydra, is on misanthropic writings by Charles Bukowski, William S. Burroughs, Anton LaVey, Lawrence Labadie, Marilisa Fiorina, and Isabel Eberhardt. Note, not Everhart, Eberhardt, as in Eberhardt Press. Come on, people. Isabel Eberhardt rocked. Check her out.
Live video series on the J20 charges from CrimeThink, quote, "Over 200 people arrested in Washington, D.C. during Trump's inauguration have been charged with 8 or more felonies apiece in a flagrant attempt at intimidation that would set an ugly precedent for future state repression. Yet in the chaotic news cycle of the Trump administration, few have even heard that this is taking place. In response, we are hosting a live video series in which legal supporters and defendants in previous politically charged court cases discuss the J20 case. The first video presentation will take place tonight, June 13th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, offering an overview of the J20 prosecution and why it is significant. The second will take place on June 19th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, bringing together legal supporters from the J20 and Standing Rock cases with the defendant from the RNC 8 conspiracy case of 2008, unquote.
New pamphlet, Tackling Energy, the Struggle Against the Construction of the Trans-Adriatic Pipeline, TAP, through Greece, Albania, Italy. Translated from Italian, this is a collection of writings against a new gas pipeline that will link up Europe with the endpoint in Turkey, the Trans-Anatolian Natural Gas Pipeline, connected with the gas fields in the Caspian Sea. The new gas pipeline will cross the north of Greece into Albania, where it will continue through the Adriatic Sea to finally reach the shores of Lecce in Italy, where they're connecting with the existing gas transport network. Author groups that are named are Circolo Anarchico and Enemies of the TAP, but most authors are not named, just the publications where the pieces were originally published. There is an extensive list of corporate sponsors of the pipeline with addresses.
Podcasts, a podcast introduction, the ideas and history of anarchism. This is about an hour and a half long. One of a number of introductions to anarchy that people are feeling inspired to do these days. This is on the pro-communist Revolutionary Left Radio podcast with historian and activist Dr. Mark Bray from the Black Rose Federation, another academic crashing in on the fascism tendency. He is pretty fair when directly asked about things he disagrees with, which happens towards the middle. He argues for limiting the definition of anarchy to its, quote, historical foundation as a kind of revolutionary socialism. They talk about the crossover between Marxism and anarchism, of course, touch on the Russian Revolution and the Spanish Civil War, argue for the organization of anarchists, encourage a big umbrella perspective, troubles the idea of left unity, and so on. Also features questions from communists, which are kind of funny if you're into that kind of thing.
With Final Straw Radio, Defend J20 Resistance, and Hamburg G20 Invite, Welcome to Hell. Sean Swain suggests anarchist convergences, aka groups of anarchists coming together to disrupt business as usual and then moving to another city to do it again. He makes it sound way more exciting than I just did. The J20 interview talks about the repressive inauguration arrests, which treated kettled people as if they were already in prison. The interview on the preparation for G20 is with two Germans who speak English well but don't get Burst's colloquialisms, which is kind of funny to listen to. Of course, international solidarity actions are encouraged. There is some discussion about the European right talking about autonomy, by which, of course, they're talking about strong nations with strong borders, obviously quite different from when anarchists talk about autonomy. And they discuss things like summit hopping and problems with it. Destiny! Destiny!
Destiny! Destiny! Destiny! Topic of the week, international anarchism. This week we're going to talk about the topic with our friend Liz, and here we go. Most often when we talk about anarchy, we are referring to that which pertains to the anarchists and anarchisms of the U.S. and to a lesser extent Canada, Mexico, Australia, and the various countries in Europe. Very often the rest of the world is either forgotten about or the anarchists in other countries simply cannot be found. For example, hardly anyone can name any anarchist groups in the two most populated countries in the world, India and China. Hong Kong doesn't count. Or the second most populous continent in the world, Africa, not counting the country of South Africa. Surely some anarchists must exist in these places, but either the connections with the Anglophone world are broken, or they are quite tenuous. Historically, there's been a number of international anarchist congresses, as well as a number of international anarchist organizations, some of which are still around. Have any of those models of the past been supportive at strengthening international bonds between different anarchists? What new models could be implemented to strengthen cross-border ties between anarchists? The internet has probably done a great deal to support international dialogue between anarchists, so how can we use that to support more international solidarity and productive relationships between anarchists from different countries? Perhaps hybrids of the old and the new can be experimented with to further anarchist internationalism. So, my first question for you, Liz, And this is, for those of you who don't know, you were involved in this project that started in 1992 called spunk.org, which, as far as I'm concerned, sort of was the promise of what the internet was going to provide for anarchists. So can you talk a little bit about spunk.org and its arc?
Yeah, spunk.org was the website of Spunk Press, which was the idea behind it was to sort of put together sort of an anarchist archive. We would get all the different anarchist publications and try to put them online. This was in 92 was the very beginnings of sort of the general public being, you know, having access to the web. It was when the Netscape web browser first came out, which sort of had a visual interface that anybody could pretty much use. Before that, it was largely limited to people who were either universities or computer companies who had access that way. Netscape kind of made the web more broadly available. And the idea with Spunk was that we would, we would make a lot of these publications and zines and magazines that had been, you know, coming out from the anarchist community forever, but they sort of, you know, they didn't have a long life. We thought maybe if we could create an archive of those, and even more ephemeral things like pamphlets people put out, and were able to put them up on the web, so that would be, you know, a good resource for people that might not have, you know, both in the U.S. and maybe smaller towns and internationally that wouldn't have access to them otherwise.
And the website was, in point of fact, run out of the Netherlands, correct?
Yes, it was run by sort of a long-term anarchist in the Netherlands, and it started, there have been a number of various forums, like there was an anarchist email list that actually still exists, and various Usenet forums, and people that sort of got to know each other on those were the ones that created Spunk Press. And it was a very good way to, I guess the early internet in general was a very good way of making those connections internationally, although I have to say that this project was very much between North America and Europe. It didn't really have much participation from, I don't even know if it had any participation from say, Asia and Africa. It really was people who were English-speaking and, you know, people in most of the Northern European countries that are, you know, in academia or, you know, computer-oriented employment, no English, and the website was pretty much, the archive was English language publications, although we would have loved to have done other things too, but it was like, you know, we didn't have those connections at the time.
The language in this topic of the week is a little strange that way, because if you're making a constraint about speaking English, then no big surprise that you're not going to know much about what's happening in Asia and Africa, you know?
Exactly. Like you said, with the exception of South Africa, that's very much true. I think Africa probably is English is a lingua franca there more than maybe it is in some parts of Asia. Certainly in China, everybody doesn't speak English, but in many African countries, people will. So, we didn't really, you know, we didn't make those connections. And I think that's something that's been an ongoing thing. There's a bit, you know, within the Francophone community, there's a bit of, you know, there's connections between France and Quebec and African French-speaking African countries to some extent, but it does divide along language lines quite strongly. I think that's still something that goes on.
One of the things that I find sort of, I guess these are the days to be a lot more cynical about the hopeful dreams of the internet. And so when I think about the early 90s and the sort of the dawning of these cables that stretched all over the world, this was clearly the utopian era. To what extent did you buy into that utopianism, you know, a long time ago now, versus how you feel about the possibilities of the internet today?
Right. Well, I was a big fan of it. And I remember trying to, you know, get more anarchists on the internet, even in the early days when people were very, very reluctant in terms of security concerns and various security concerns, and just, you know, not a lot of people knew a great deal about it. But I was pretty enthused about it because I did think it was a way to reach people outside of, you know, I grew up in kind of a medium-sized town without a lot of anarchists in it, without any that I knew, and just the potential to be able to make connections worldwide seemed great, and it still seems great. And I think even with something like Facebook, with all the problems it has, it does let people meet people in different areas in a way that they probably wouldn't be able to do in any other way. But like you said, there's a lot of problems with it in the fact that it's commercialized, it's surveillance state has its finger in everything, it's run by corporations. So I think the potential is still there. It's, you know, to be a decentralized way for people to communicate with each other, but, you know, we're using tools that are not, you know, made for us, essentially. They're made to make people money or to let the state watch us.
I mean, I guess for me, you know, when I think back to where we learn about anarchist internationalism, which is sort of in the pages of books like Emma Goldman's autobiography and books of that era, it seems like anarchists as a type traveled a lot and really, you know, traveled across borders.
I think they did. And I think that was the case with, you know, with my experience in the, you know, mid to late 80s and 90s, there was a lot of, you know, traveling to, they called it summit hopping, you know, traveling to a gathering here or traveling to a protest somewhere that would have a kind of a convergence around it. And a lot of people did come together that way. But I think, you know, it was a segment of people who had the time and the resources to travel. And that was probably a narrow segment of everybody. But I think, you know, I think all along there has been, you know, anarchism has been a very internationalist movement. And I think that's still true today. Still true today.
Did you make it to the Toronto convergence? Was that 88?
Yes, I went to the 88 one. I went to the 89 one in San Francisco. And I went to a number of, you know, the WTO protests in Seattle and various ones that followed that. And, you know, the internationalism was part of, especially the one in Quebec City, which I think was 2003. You know, there was a lot of international presence there, a lot of Italians and, you know, French people. And it was great because it really did bring people together. But even then, it's, you know, people were somewhat segregated by who spoke what language.
Right. And I mean, that actually is still a major division in the Montreal scene, which is the most bilingual in the at least in the US and Canada.
Right.
When you went to Toronto, of course, you were much younger. Did you feel like you were in a foreign place and in a different
It did, because I hadn't traveled as much as I have since then through my work. So yeah, like being in, and even though it's, you know, it's North America, there's a lot of similarities. There was a lot of things that felt different too. Although I have to say that probably the majority, a lot of the people that were there were Americans, U.S. Americans. So I think I felt like the Quebec City one was the one that really felt like, wow, you know, we're really different. And I remember reading people saying things online like, you know, there's this little like mini Europe, you know, a couple hours north of New York that we didn't even know was there.
You know, when I think about internationalism nowadays, I think about a project that we did that sort of learned a lot of its lessons from Spunk.org, and this launched about 10 years ago. It was called the Anarchist Library. And the Anarchist Library wouldn't be possible if it weren't for international people. The primary person who did the technology for the library is actually based out of Croatia. And the library today is actually amazing because it has about a half dozen languages that are currently active with submissions and sort of different pools of people approving of texts. So the Anarchist Library really, you know, sort of like learned what Spunk did and really improved it. And it sort of was an amazing international project.
Right. And I think what Spunk was working with at the time, there wasn't a lot that was actually produced and put on the web originally. So it was going back and, you know, finding the text if you could do that or scanning something in and trying to get what had been solely print publications into a digital format. Now, of course, a lot of things come out digitally originally, or else say there's a digital file that is used to make the print version. So that makes it much easier to have those things, you know, accessible.
No, actually, one of the charming things about Splunk is if you go in there and try to dig around for text, you can see all the classic scanning errors, you know, the two L's being read as a U, and
right.
all the different sort of adorable scanning artifacts from back in the day.
Right. And, you know, that technology has improved, but without it, you know, it's like you can sort of take a picture or, a PDF or a JPEG or something, but then it's not searchable and you're hard pressed to really make as much use of the text as you could. And, you know, I think I'll give a plug for, it's not an anarchist project per se, but something like the Internet Archive, I think, has kind of carried on that spirit of trying to, you know, put everything out there, make it as accessible as possible for free to everybody. And, you know, the people that are sort of behind it, I think, have that kind of a, I don't know if they would consider themselves anarchist or not, but they have that kind of mindset of, you know, putting information out there for free for everybody is a good idea, and it's not about us making money.
Mm. Yeah, the other thing I was going to mention in that same vein, lost my train of thought. I guess the thing that has changed the most, and it's interesting that you mentioned that there were security concerns in the early 90s, but the thing that does resonate to me that's the more modern, anarchist attitude is sort of the idea of being a secret agent and not wanting to share your name or any identifiable information about yourself. And so therefore not really collaborating on any internet platform, even if it's absolutely sort of not illegal and not particularly dangerous. It's definitely harder nowadays, I feel like, to get anarchists to collaborate on the internet because of sort of security concerns, but they're not exactly security concerns. They're more like, I guess, privacy concerns.
Yes. And I don't know if that's worse now or then. I feel like that's been kind of a barrier that's been there since the early internet. There's always been anarchists that have, used assumed names or whatever. And I think, we can say it's not that dangerous, but you never know what's going to be dangerous as regimes change. Something that doesn't seem dangerous now could end up being dangerous. And I think, you've even seen that with Facebook and other social media. Now there's talk of, as you travel over borders, somebody's going to take your phone and want your password so they can see what you say on Facebook. And, it may be something that you thought was completely innocuous, but they're going to trace you to somebody who said something that wasn't. I think there's real reason for concern, and it's always sort of balancing act between how much privacy you give up for the sake of making more connections. And, I've sort of been on the more connections end in part because I was open about anarchism and stuff on the internet in the very early years when, I guess, we didn't think it, our five, 10-year-old niece would ever be on the internet, or our mother. It was only going to be, people that were sort of in the industry or in academia or activists or, but now that it's gone further than that, and anything you have ever put on the internet is going to be findable. And I think that's not an unreasonable worry at all, to worry about that.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Weekly Anarchy 101 question and some answers. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org, a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. It has nearly 10 years of questions and answers. The question this week is, how fundamental is money to capitalism? Does creating a moneyless world solve many or most of the problems that anarchists have with the current situation? If so, what are the best ways to combat money as a phenomenon? Answer 1. For me, this raises the question, what is the relationship between money and value/exchange, doing away with money per se? While I would love to see that happen regardless, it doesn't inherently do away with the mindset of value exchange, which exists independently of money, a medium of exchange. How tightly those are interwoven and interdependent is anyone's guess. We can't know without doing away with the thing, money, to see how that impacts the way of thinking. I find this analogous and related to the similar question of sustainability. Doing away with fossil fuels and other unsustainable technologies doesn't necessarily change the way people consume. and it is that consumption that seems unsustainable. If there were suddenly enough sun, wind, water, energy products to provide the same umpteen gazillion petawatts that the world currently uses, humans would likely make no changes in their consumption patterns. Likewise, doing away with money as a medium of exchange would not necessarily change the mindset of value exchange, hoarding, profit, etc. Next answer. Money is absolutely fundamental to capitalism. The establishment of money is one of many roles that the state has played historically in laying the groundwork for capitalism, and one of the many continuing reasons that capitalism still could not exist without the state. All market economies that we know about so far, either historically or anthropologically, have been based on a standardized medium of exchange to facilitate commercial transactions, i.e. money. All such standardized mediums of exchange that we know about so far have been imposed by the state. Examples of non-monetary market economies based on barter have invariably been situations where a monetary system had once existed, but later collapsed or become inaccessible, such as the dissolution of the USSR or much of the colonial pre-United States. Non-monetary economies don't tend to operate according to the logic of barter or market exchange at all, but rather systems of what an anarchist might recognize as mutual aid. Such arrangements have been described by different academics as generalized reciprocity, gift economy, primitive communism, noble savagery, barbarity, etc. It is of little consequence whether the currency is coinage, printed money, or printed paper, or standardized measurements of barley. All have functioned as money, and all have been imposed by the state, usually as a method of standardizing tax collection to pay soldiers. The market economy did not exist before money, and money did not exist before the state. If money somehow disappeared, market exchange could not be conducted in a manner conducive to the social institutions of capitalism. The idea that wage labor or investment banking could function through the trade of eggs for pieces of fabric is absurd. This is not to say that the abolition of money equals anarchy and freedom. I just don't think any system that could be described as capitalism could exist without that green, or measured denominations of salt, as the case may be. And the third answer. Money is not fundamental to capitalism. Capitalism could exist just fine without money. Money, according to Marx, is a commodity just like any other commodity. The only difference is that many commodities have a use value that would still exist outside of capitalism. Food can still be eaten, shoes could still be worn, etc. Money, on the other hand, has as its only use value that it lubricates the process of exchange. Money does not have a stable exchange value because it is used as a unit to measure the exchange value of other commodities. When you go through a process of exchange to get money, money is not actually the thing that you want, but you see money as its potential to quickly and easily exchange itself for other commodities. To abolish money would make capitalism slower and more cumbersome. The minute I see "make capitalism slower and more cumbersome anarchy" on a banner, I will lower my black flag and burn my anarchy card. There are places in the world where money is not the most efficient commodity at lubricating exchange. In a sense, money loses its use value. In places where the exchange value of money tends to go down quickly or change rapidly, people often will use a different commodity to store their wealth in. This other commodity can become a new money, even though it has an alternate use value and was not designed for this purpose. Brick is a common new money. I wish this were a Settler of Catan joke, but it's real shit. As long as commodities exist, there will be a commodity that performs the task of money. A better known and more humorous story about money is when money gains additional use values. There have been times and places where money is not properly performing its function of lubricating exchange because its exchange value is so low. We have all heard stories about pre-World War II Germany where it took a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread. At these times and places, people find new uses for their gigantic stacks of useless paper, such as wallpaper, kindling, fuel for a fire, for heat and cooking purposes. The main critics I see of money, quote-unquote, are the Zeitgeist movement wingnuts. They argue instead for a resource-based economy, which is an entirely meaningless term. To refer to the world as resources already shows a degree of alienation and strongly hints toward a replication of the commodity form. To answer your second question, no. Abolishing money does nothing to end the state and end capitalism, end prison, borders, imperialist war, wealth, poverty, white supremacist settler colonialism, cis-heteropatriarchy, alienation, work, etc., or any of the constant abuses that come from these things. For more on money and commodities, read Capital by Karl Marx. As always, if you don't like these answers or you have your own question to ask, visit anarchy101.org and join the conversation.
Money in the studio, money takes all day, money take my breath away, melody oh baby hey, money technical.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel, written by Jackie, produced and narrated by Aragorn Chisel and a friend. Thanks to Liz for their help with the topic of the week. and contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist material, littleblackcart.com, news and up-to-the-minute commentary, anarchistnews.org.
Melody, oh baby, hey. Technicality, really actually. Money on a gold plate, making music all day. In the studio, vocal takes all day. Vocals take my breath away. Melody, oh.